This is Angela with the Fandible.com role-playing podcast. I'm alone this week, kinda sorta, cause Fandible is trying something new and we're starting to do some interviews. And for our very first podcast interview, here we have David Hill, who is with Machine Age Productions, which designed Machine Zeit, which Fandible played not too long ago. And he's here to talk about his new game, The Gospel of Sarah, which is currently being funded on Indiegogo. So welcome, David.
Hello, Angela.
So first things first, for the people that haven't heard about it, what is The Gospel of Sarah? What is it about?
Okay, so it's a little complicated. It's one of those ones that's a little hard to elevator pitch. It is a game that is sort of it's tied up in some like religious mythology, some fictitious religious mythology, but it's really sort of like a psychological thriller game, in the vein of things like Hellraiser, that sort of thing. It's about introspective horror. It's about approaching and overcoming boundaries and really just sort of like getting into some frightening, depraved, weird stuff.
Okay, cool. What made you want to tackle something that's like part Hellraiser, part fictitious religious mythology? What made you want to go for something like that for a game?
Well, I think there's a cynical answer and then there's a more realistic answer. The cynical answer is I was watching the later Hellraiser movies and I was angry because I didn't get to do them. and I felt that pretty much anyone could have done them better.
Oh.
So that's a cynical answer. Honestly, though, it's because I've been thinking a lot about different ways to do horror in games. I was listening to someone who I, you know, really respect his opinions and everything, but he said that it's really impossible to do horror in a role-playing game. And I was like, well, that's kind of weird because that's what I do. And I do a lot of horror games. I've done them before, Machine Zeit, for example. But you can't say that you can't do horror in a game, because there's just different things that horror means to different people, in different ways that you can go about it. So the traditional, you know, jump out and scare you horror that you get in a lot of movies these days, yeah, you can't really do that. Doesn't really work within the frame of a game, mm-hmm. But there are a lot of things that you can do, and I wanted to explore one of them, and that would be the psychological horror.
Well, yeah, it's great, because that's, when Fandible does horror games, almost, you know, I'd say 99% of them have been the psychological horror. I mean, when we did Machine Zeit, it really got into body horror, and it was freaking me out at the table. I, like, just kind of wanted to crawl under the table to get away from some of these horrific descriptions that were going on. So, yeah, it's really interesting that someone would think that horror doesn't work at a tabletop game.
I can understand why, though. Like, I remember when I was growing up, like, you know, you'd play the Ravenloft and whatever, and you, if you have the books right there in front of you, and you have the lists of things that the monsters are capable of doing, and you know all of the secrets, and mm-hmm. you know that the GM is ultimately going to let you win in the end, or whatever, that doesn't really lend itself toward horror. And the slow-paced narrative structure that you get in a game, where you're describing your character's actions, and then you're pausing to roll to do something, that doesn't really lend itself to horror either very well.
That's a good point. So one of the other things that your Indiegogo page states that Gospel of Sarah is about is this is a horror game, and it's about consent. And there's been, you know, conversations on the internet. I followed a couple on Google+. About, you know, what does consent mean in the context of a game? Because for some people, consent is very much a legal definition. I consent to this sort of activity. For others, it's tied up in the kink community of safe, sane, and consensual. So I wanted to give you a chance and to comment on what does consent mean for you in the context of this game and what people should be cognizant of when they come into a horror game about consent.
Well, it's definitely the latter. Like, the safe, sane, and consensual idea is really core to what The Gospel of Sarah is. The reason why I call it a horror game about consent is that the mythology of the game says that there are these terrible, terrible forces in the world, these sort of, like, demon things, and their entire purpose is not to punish you, but is to give you what you want. And the characters in the Gospel of Sarah oftentimes want punishment. They want terrible things to happen. They're self-destructive people. And so these demons can't just go around wantonly destroying things and killing people. They can only do the things that you deep down in your heart want them to do to you. So it's a game about exploring that and about finding out what your character wants and seeing if your character is able to admit that to themselves. Maybe they're able to get past it. Maybe they're able to move away from their damage. Maybe they're able to evolve and grow. Maybe they're not. Maybe they're going to walk down that path of self-destruction. Mm-hmm. The only way that I can approach that reasonably in the scope of a game is making the entire game system about consent. The entire mechanic, it's a diceless game. They're technically dice, but they're not really used in the resolution mechanic. But it's a diceless game, and your economy is consent. You are going to have these sort of points that you can earn and you can use in order to step back. If things get too intense, you step back. You say, this is too much. And that's fine, because you have the ability to do that. The mechanics themselves reflect a loss of agency, a willing loss of agency. So if I'm doing something, if I'm narrating a scene for my character, and I have to overcome a challenge, the way that I overcome that challenge is there are sort of mini games that you do with the other players around the table where they take over a little bit of the narrative for you. So if you're on in an early part of the game and you're just sort of barely confronting these personal demons, you do your scene, and another player might be say, can I add a subtext to this scene? And so you're like, okay, you know, I'm fighting with my father. I'm going to add a subtext. Add a subtext to the scene. And the other player says, okay, we'll say sexually charged. You're like, whoa, I think I can run with that. And then you start to narrate the scene with that subtext, and that's just a minor way that they influence your agency. You could step back if you wanted to, but you are rewarded for engaging that. And then later on, it might be a situation of you're in an argument with your wife, and another player says, can I take control of your character for 5 minutes? And if you say no, that's fine, you can do that. If you say yes, you're rewarded, but then you have to deal with what happened.
Sure. So I like that consent is again built into a mechanic where, you know, with the sexually charged example, if I, you know, either I guess I don't feel that's right for my character, or if I'm just not comfortable role-playing that at this moment, I can say, no. Is that correct? Am I getting that correct?
You do have the ability to withdraw at any time. Everything that you do, because your character is consenting to everything, your character wants to be punished, your character mm-hmm. wants to go through with this, or at least that's what you're exploring. So as a player, you have to be able to say, no, I'm done with this, I'm going to step back. And one of the fun things that we can do as far as the basic mechanisms go is we can say that didn't really happen. If in the heat of the moment, the two players are narrating the scene together, and things get a little far, things get a little weird, but those things have been narrated and have been discussed, you can say, all right, this is what we call an alter ego scene. My character sees it in their mind. I totally recognize that these things happen in my mind. I experienced it up there. It was a part of my subconscious. And I know, okay, so in the scene, I killed my wife. I know what would happen if I decided to do that. And that played through my character's mind. And it's there, and it's damaging, and it's hurtful, but it didn't actually happen.
Okay. So what's the kind of end goal for the characters? Is it to give in to this desire to be punishment, desire to be punished, to seek out as much punishment as possible? Or is it to overcome these darker desires and come out on top as a better person at the end? Or is it something else?
You're going to find out basically during play what your character's endgame is.
Mm-hmm.
Once you have basically walked the labyrinth of your mind and you come out, your character will overcome this sort of puzzle that unlocks the secrets of another world and gives you access to these demons. And then you're going to pull basically a slip of paper out of a bag, and it's going to have something on it. If it's the thing that you added to the bag, then you get your deepest desire. You get to indulge in that terrible thing that you have.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't get yours and you pull someone else's, you're going to see their name and you're going to see their deep, dark desire. And you have two choices. There's also going to be written on that piece of paper a dark fate, a terrible thing. Maybe you are, picked up my fish books or something. I don't know. But it says something terrible. Something terrible is on that piece of paper. And you have two choices. You can either suffer that fate and recognize my character feels that they need to be punished. I'm giving up my character. You walk into the room and my character is just ripped to shreds by these demons. It's a terrible, terrible, gory thing, whatever. Or you listen to the whispers in your mind. You listen to those demons and you take a look at that name and that dark desire and you try to tempt that person toward their self-destruction.
Okay.
So you either be destroyed or you become an agent of that destruction.
Interesting. So you mentioned that this is a diceless game, and there's a mention of the labyrinth that you walk. So I know from reading about this that you've based the game, core mechanic of the game is actually like one of the first board games that we've been able to track down, the game of Ur. Where on earth did that come from? Was it you found this game and then you wanted to build a game around it, or did the idea for the Gospel of Sarah come first, and as you were digging around for a mechanic, you found this board game?
Well, it had been sort of like in the back of my mind for a bit, because I'd seen the game at museums and such. It's easily 5,000 years old. It's very, very old. And I've always been fascinated with sort of the history of games and where they came from. This game, like, grew into backgammon and a lot of other things, but I was very fascinated with it. There aren't really complete rules out there for how to play this game, so I was like, you know, what if it was put here by something else? Like, maybe games were introduced to us by something else. So I'm going to use this as part of my game mechanic. So with Gospel of Sarah specifically, it worked really well because we have these otherworldly forces. We have these sort of like temptation forces that want to do things in the world to bring these people towards their destruction. And so in my narrative, basically these demons, these otherworldly forces, put these games here to influence people to puzzle themselves, to put themselves through the rigor of games and of puzzles in order to tempt themselves towards madness. And that's the core mechanic to determine what you have to do in a scene to get out. You're walking around this board as you play. You roll a couple of dice to see where you go on the board, but the actual game mechanics don't use the dice. That's just to determine what you're doing in the scene.
Okay, that's really interesting. I really like that idea of exploring where games come from as actually part of informing like the history of this game and as a mechanic. So it's been said that the Gospel of Sarah is not going to be a game for everyone because of some of these darker, more uncomfortable themes that are being explored. But who would you say the game is for? If it's not for everyone, who is it actually for?
Well, it's a game for people who are interested, for one, in exploring mature topics in a game. It's good for people who have pre-established relationships. Mm-hmm. I would probably not play a very intense game of this with people at a convention, for example.
Sure.
If I were playing it, say, on like a Google Hangout or something, I would definitely want to familiarize myself with the players and get comfortable with them first. You know, address topics, let them know this is what's going to go on, this might be what's going to go on, how can we make this work? It's not a pickup game that you just play with anyone.
Sure.
I would say that anyone who is, I don't play it with anyone that you are not comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there are a lot of games I will play with pretty much anyone. You know, if someone wants to play Dungeons & Dragons or whatever, I will do that. You know, icky topics might come up, but I can just gloss over them because that's not what the game is about.
Mm-hmm.
The Gospel of Sarah, introspection is the heart of the game. It has to happen.
One thing I found kind of cool about your process for this is that you're actually deep in the design process right now. This isn't a finished game that you're funding for. You're actually working on it, and we're getting kind of live updates as you're, you know, we're seeing things as you write them. Does that add any pressure to this, to the design process? Do you think there's benefits to it as opposed to having an all-finished game that you're then trying to get funding for?
Well, I've always been very public about my processes. I've always blogged about them. And this one is more so. I'm posting about it more. I'm trying to be more upfront about it. I was expecting that it might be more challenging because I figured that more people would come up with, you know, opposition to what I'm doing or you know, arguments about the way I'm wording things or whatever. But so far it's been really supportive, which has actually been great. It's been very helpful because a lot of people are very excited for it and are excited to see a game that tackles these concepts correctly. That's not something that they're used to.
Yeah.
So it's been very encouraging, and it's been keeping me going, because I know these people want to see more, so I want to give it to them. And it's been nice. I'm getting into the actual mechanics stuff right now. That's where I'm getting at, like, this week, basically. So I'll see how that goes, see what people are thinking at that point.
Kind of moving on to more generally talking more about your history as a game designer. You know, you've done a wide variety of games at Machine Age Productions, all different styles, different tones, different mechanic systems. How do you keep it fresh? You know, how do you keep coming up with these new and really innovative ideas?
Well, the idea that I am concerned about is keeping specific. I've never been one to enjoy, like, generic games. Like, the first thing, if someone is trying to pitch a game to me, the first thing that'll turn me off is if I ask them, what's your game about, and what can it do? And they say anything. Because at that point, usually, I feel that they don't do anything well. They just do everything kind of mediocre.
Mm-hmm.
So I lean toward the very specific. Instead of doing a horror game, I do a psychological horror game, or I do a, you know, body horror and, you know, haunted ghost or space station game. I could do 50 horror games if I wanted to, and they would all be completely distinct. I believe that game rules and game design are all about sort of like finding the narrative that you want to present and finding a way to model that in the sort of rules. And if, as long as I am finding different narratives to present, I can find different ways to represent them with rules. That's what's kept me going.
What made you want to be a game designer? You know, what made you want to make that leap from playing games to actually making them yourself?
Well, I felt that growing up, like, I always designed games. I just didn't really know that that's what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of people do that. You know, very few people just play games right out the box. They'll tinker with them, they'll toy with them, they'll do house rules, they'll do their own model or whatever. And I did it so much that it got to the point where I felt, I'm not even playing their games anymore, I'm playing my own.
Sure.
And a lot of other people liked those. And they started to realize, David, we're not playing the game that we say that we are playing, we're playing this weird thing that you're doing. Why don't you publish that? And that worked for me.
Yeah, I like the point that, you know, people are kind of, we start doing this almost unconsciously. When I used to run a guild in City of Heroes, one of our questions that we asked people was, how long have you been role-playing? And the best answer we ever got was someone saying, I always have, because I used to play pretend on the playground.
Yep.
And so I like this idea that actually making games is something that's very inherent in people, and we just kind of overcomplicate it when we become adults and we're like, oh, I'm going to publish a game, and it's almost like the psychological barrier to overcome.
Yeah, well, we like to play stories, we like playing parts, we like involving ourselves in things, and we like making rules. that's what people do. They make rule systems. That's government for you. And we're just doing the same thing, except, you know, we're not, like, torturing anyone.
Yes, I hope not, at least. What is your favorite part of the design process?
That's a hard one.
I know.
So it's sort of equally the front end and the back end of it. I love brainstorming. I love sitting around groups of people and just sort of love shooting the shit, coming up with ideas, determining how I would model things. And then I also really like, once the book exists and once it's in people's hands, I love that side of it. Because for one, like, my job is done, like, I don't have to worry about it at that point. And for another, like, that's why I do it. I don't make books so they can, you know, sit around. I make them so people can read them and enjoy them and play the games out of them. And once that's happening, I feel like the thing is complete.
Okay. Just to kind of follow up on that, I know this is kind of another difficult question to get into, but as a kind of an aspiring game designer myself, for me, the hardest part is figuring out how on earth do you get started? You know, I can pick up a book that teaches me how to write a novel, but there aren't as many guides like that for designing a game. So, you know, you mentioned that when you're at the beginning of the process and you're sitting around brainstorming, you know, what exactly is the beginning of the design process for you?
The beginning of the design process or the beginning of the getting involved in design by certain topics?
designing, like, a specific game. Like, when you're saying, like, all right, I want to get a new game started, where do you start?
Where I start is I usually, usually that occurs with the assistance of my wife. We are usually sitting around and talking, and we see something or hear something, read something that we think that we would, I think that we could do this better. So we will see, like, you know, say we're watching Leverage or whatever, Supernatural or whatever. Those are bad examples because they already have a really good game. But we see something and we're like, we would do this differently. In the scope of this narrative, we would want to do this differently. Our characters would definitely approach this in a completely different way. So then we're like, how? And that's sort of the logical jump. Because I know everyone watches TV and read books and whatever and thinks, I will do this differently. But then the next step, the step that becomes design, is how do I do this? And that you, at that point, you are designing from that point on.
Okay. Do you have any advice for other designers, people that are just kind of getting started, people like me, maybe? But, you know, if you were talking to a group of new designers, what are some of the most important pieces of advice you think they could use?
Okay, yeah, there's some good ones out there. The first one that I would say is that, like, mentors are the thing. You can't just pick up a book. Like, you can ask people, oh, is there a book on game design? Yeah, there are books on game design, there are books on game theory, but I don't really feel that a lot of that is very useful because it is theory. Usually, the best thing that you can do is find yourself a mentor, talk to people, sort of engage in those communities. Like, my Google Plus is a great example. I know a lot of people have started making games because of the engagement that they've gotten there. So that's something. Another big point, don't get married to your ideas. A lot of times I'll do, like, educational panels and seminars. I do one called Design RPG in an Hour at a lot of different cons, Gen Con and PAX and stuff. And every time I get people who afterwards, they ask me, well, how do I protect my idea? Because I've got this really great idea for a game, and I'm just afraid that if, like, I start working on it and talk to people about it, that someone's going to steal it. Well, no. Really, games aren't about ideas. Games are about execution. And nobody's going to steal your execution unless you are, and if they do, you'd just be flattered, but nobody's going to steal your idea. And if they do, if it was able to be stolen, and if it was able to be done by someone else, then maybe you should have rethought it. Maybe it wasn't the thing to begin with. Let's see. Other ones. My big issue with game design is, like, I believe that it is our job to make people have fun. I am sort of, like, very open and outspoken about this fact. It's my job to make people have fun. And the more people I can make have fun, the better I am doing my job. So if you are making a game and you are trying to do something that you want people to have fun with, you've got to consider that people other than you are going to be playing the game. So if you are excluding them inherently in what you are doing, if you are not being considerate to them, their needs, their wants, their desires, it's just not going to work. That's the problem with the whole chainmail bikini thing. That's a huge potential market that gets alienated by one little thing that you just don't have to do. Like, it's not like a big deal. It's not, like, inherently essential to what you are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Those three things: be inclusive, don't get married to your ideas, and have a mentor.
Good. Those are all great ideas. Absolutely. Google Plus has helped me so much. Just opening up the idea that, because I didn't know very much about indie games actually before I found the community on Google Plus. So the idea that there's people out there other than White Wolf and Wizards of the Coast that are designing games, just like, even if it's just them and their five friends that want to play it, it's been so freeing to see how all the different, sometimes really crazy and weird ideas that other people are working with and turning into games. That was all I had for questions. Is there anything else that you would like to say about the Gospel of Sarah, about design in general, anything that we haven't touched on yet?
The Gospel of Sarah specifically this time, it's a little bit different than most of my projects. Usually what I end up doing is I'll use a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo or something. I'll crowdfund the game in order to get front run going and just make the game happen. And then I will continue to promote the game for a very long time. You know, I'll make supplements, I'll work on it and stuff. The Gospel of Sarah is, like, a really personal sort of, It's a one-time project. I didn't really intend on doing a lot of supplementary material for it, and I don't really intend on it being something that I, you know, am pushing heavily at convention, whatever. So it's a game that it's going to happen. It's basically going to happen now. I'm looking at it less as a product for the future and more as an event. It's a thing that I'm doing now. It's different than anything we've ever done, and basically it's our opportunity to be ambitious. So, you know, people are talking about that and talking about this. It's a lot different. It's definitely an art project. It's not a traditional game, and it doesn't even follow my rules. it's not an inclusive game. It is more exclusive than anything else that we have done. My wife was speaking there. It isn't meant for everyone, and that's very difficult for me to do. So this is, you know, it's a very nerve-wracking project for me in that regard. It's not something I'm used to.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you the best of luck with it. It sounds really interesting. I think even if it's not a game for everyone, I think that everyone can see that you're doing something really different and innovative, and I think that's something that should always be applauded. You know, there's that that horrible thing that people like to say whenever people complain about a game, and that's, well, go make your own. And, you know, aside from all the issues of availability and that people have gone over 100 million times, I do think that there is value in having games that will appeal to different demographics. And, you know, on one hand, while it's good to have games that are inclusive, not every game has to be for everyone. Because like you were saying earlier, if a game can do anything, well, does it do anything very well? So I think specifying and getting really into doing one type of one thing really well is certainly of value and of use, even if it's not something that everyone would actually want to get into.
And yeah, that's definitely the sort of approach that I'm taking to this. I all the time tell people it's okay to not like things, like it's okay to not be into things. But then again, like there's a difference between something being something that people aren't into and things that are actually like sort of like making people not feel good or, you know, making people not feel well. This is not a Dungeons and Dragons. This is not a game that I expect to be on bookshelves. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't going to go into stores or anything like that. So I am perfectly comfortable making it, you know, a tiny thing like that. It's an opportunity for me to sort of like feel out and see what level of innovation and what level of experimentation people want from my products. I've done in the past so many games, and I've strived to do weird, fun, but still inclusive things. And this is a weird thing. Like, there's a little bit psychosexual going on, and that's not very common in game spheres. Like, I talk to a lot of people who say, this sounds really cool, but I could never get my players to play it. maybe that's a thing. Like, maybe that's okay. Like, maybe it's a thing that you want to read and get a feel for and enjoy that way, and maybe mine it for ideas or something. I totally understand if your players are not comfortable with playing out someone's, like, deep, strange fantasies and wishes for self-destruction.
Yeah, like, I have to admit, you know, as cool as I think this sounds, I'm not sure it's going to be a fandable game. Because even if we do decide to play it, I'm not sure I want those things out on the internet for anyone to hear me say.
Exactly. It's going to be very challenging to get people to do, like, actual play recording.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm really interested in seeing it. Maybe there's a way to kind of twist it and bend it. And, you know, if we set up those clear boundaries ahead of time, maybe there'll be something we can make out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's all I have. David, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with me and kind of be my guinea pig for doing an interview.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'm so glad that you had me. It was fun.
Thanks. And best of luck with the Indiegogo campaign. I'm going to include a link to it in the show notes so that anyone that's listening can go and contribute. When does the campaign end, David?
It's like right before the end of the year. I want to say without opening my web browser that it's like the 28th.
That sounds about right.
So it's, I know it's before the end of the year.
Yeah, it's after Christmas, but
it's Christmas to, you know, settle down and digest their food.
Recover from family visiting. That's what I'll be doing.
Exactly, exactly. And it's a cathartic experience. You know, you talk about self-destruction after meeting with the in-laws for a couple days.
This has been Angela with the Fandible.com role-playing podcast doing our first interview with David Hill for the Gospel of Sarah Indiegogo. Thank you for listening, and I hope everyone checks it out.